they will get all the information out tonight. All the case information should be out to you guys. It's 6 pages long. It came from Casino just last week, and it'll come through the manager's account, so just look out for that. And if you have any questions, we're going to have some sort of correspondence system where you guys can continue to ask questions. And Casino wants to set up a one-hour lunch with all the teams to kind of serve as an advisory role. So whenever you guys have time, you can correspond with Casino directly to have this little lunch meeting. Okay? And with that said, I will pass to Cliff.
Today we're very excited to have Al coming back here to speak to us. He's an alumni of NYU. He started a home consulting firm straight out of college. So, what for you, Al?
Hi, everyone. No, keep the applause down to a minimum. I was really thinking about what to talk about today, and I figured I'll start off with a rhetorical question, and then I'm going to give you a broad overview of the history of consulting, and then discuss the types of consulting. Now, I know you think you know, but hear me out first. And then I'm going to tell you about, you know, what you do as a consultant, because this is probably the number one question I always get.
The history of consulting.
Why do you guys want to be consultants? I'm assuming you want to be consultants. You're not just here for the tasty pizza. That's the rhetorical question. Now, what's the history of consulting? Does anybody shout out anything that you know? Very good. You guys are obviously very learned in consulting. I'm about to tell you something you may not have expected, but this is the truth. Consulting is probably one of the oldest professions, unknown professions. It's maybe like 7,000-8,000 years old. One of the first consultants was actually those guys that tasted the Pharaoh's food to make sure it wasn't poisoned. You know, then you live, basically, you know, the Pharaoh could eat the food. And that was pretty much the first type of consulting job. Throughout the years, and let's fast forward to approximately 1850. Actually, no, even better time to fast forward to would be 1776. Some would say this is a very, you know, momentous occasion in the history of the U.S. This was when a bunch of guys sat around and said, you know what, we don't like kings, we don't like monarchs, let's just start our own country. Which is a you know, sort of the thinking I had when I graduated. And what occurred was these guys created this thing called the Constitution, and they wrote it pretty much to prevent the country from falling into the hands of a monarch. So you know there's a legislative, there's an executive, there's a judicial branch. Well, at the time, it was pretty much all about the legislative. All these learned men knew was law, legal stuff, law. Executives pretty much didn't have a say-so in it. So they created this whole constitution, which was revised again, which was subsequently revised throughout the decade, until sometime around the 1850s, you had all the states sort of redo their constitutions based on what came out of that particular occasion. And what happened? Every state, taking the lead, gave more authority to their legislative branch and less authority to their executive branch. Judicial was pretty much, you know, like, okay, they're there. What are we going to do? It was all set up to prevent, again, these big, powerful monarchs or any major big shot from taking over the country. What occurred was, surprisingly, folks like mayors, folks like governors, even as far up as the president, really didn't have that much authority, surprisingly. Men were governed by laws, and they were not had any discretion to do anything that they wanted to do. So by the turn of the century, the country was unmanageable. By the 1910s, you actually had the development of, not the development, I should say sometime around this period, Arthur D. Little was founded. And then around here, Booz Allen was also founded. Why were these two founded around these times, and why am I talking about government? Simple. The country was, again, unmanageable, and this went filtered all the way down to states, and it filtered all the way down to countries. Arthur D. Little's major contribution was to engineering. Booz Allen Hamilton's major contribution was to government contracts. Surprisingly, these guys were, you guys know who Arthur D. Little and Booz Allen are, right? Right? Yes? No? Who doesn't? Okay. Arthur D. Little is considered the oldest consulting firm around. They got started sometime in the 1890s. They are primarily based in Europe now. They almost have very little presence here in the U.S. And Booth Allen Hamilton is the second oldest at almost 90 years old. They were started pretty much to take advantage of all these changes occurring. What were the changes? Government said, you know, we're facing really, really good times. We have all these guys sitting around doing nothing. Let's see if maybe they can tell us how to improve our government structure. But again, it wasn't really a big deal. You know, people weren't really into, fixing anything because, you know, everything seemed to work okay. It wasn't until the Great Depression, real dramatic thing, that people said, you know what? Something ain't right here. As a matter of fact, as early as 1917, J.P. Morgan was still bailing the country out of problems. People did not like, despite the fact that earlier on, Alexander Hamilton invented the Fed and, you know, kind of sort of, the Treasury, I'm sorry, and kind of sort of made all currencies throughout the country the same. So right around here, when we had the first serious major financial crisis, J.P. Morgan bailed, you guys know who J.P. Morgan is, right? Okay. Senior sort of started the business in London, and Junior took it over. They looked so alike, nobody could tell the difference. So, in 1917, Junior bailed the country out. He was the big shot. So 1929 came around. You know, that times were so fantastic. It was very similar to, like, you know, 2000, 1999. Very similar. Everything went to hell. People were like, hold on a second. We can't keep calling it JP. JP's like 90. He's not going to do anything. You know, our good buddy, Mr. Monopolizer, Rockefeller, you know, he's not going to build a country out. He doesn't really care. Surprisingly, Rockefeller himself was a very adept consultant. Sort of around here, he's sort of like 1848 and below. He really, you know, knew something about process improvement, which, you know, I'm not going to get into, but 1929, the market crashed, and then they realized, you know what, we need something better to work. So what happened? They actually started fixing the country. Good old FDR, right? FDR says, we need a new deal. These guys can't keep taking over. This was the first time in probably the history of the Constitution that somebody said, you know what, I don't F the legislation. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and he actually got it done. So, you know, fast forward 1935, and we had other new developments occurring in management consulting. Particularly that lawyers were not exploring the business. Now, sporadically, an occasional lawyer or two would get into the business. You know, it would be like one guy, two guys, they're pretty much advising on laws, how to get out of problems. Engineers really sort of took advantage of the First World War, that's what I actually meant to say, to really start talking about process improvement and how to manage project management, the war. But it wasn't around 1935 that you really saw something that you probably never heard of before. Or you probably didn't see you may not have heard this before. Harvard Law School was as prestigious as you can get to be a lawyer. Harvard's MBA program really wasn't, you know, people said, well, you're a lawyer already, what do you want to go do that for? Business is for chumps, you know. But one particular individual said, you know what, that's not entirely true. Mr. Marvin Bower, anybody heard of this guy? Marvin Bower is the modern day father of McKinsey. You know McKinsey? Who doesn't know McKinsey? Okay, that's a positive for the consulting group. Okay, so Marvin Bower, he says, you know what? Our good friend James O. McKinsey is dead. You know, he actually did founded the company as an accounting firm. And he subsequently took a job as a CEO of Marshall Fields, and then he had a heart attack and died, like around 40. Marvin Bower, together with our good buddy A.T. Kearney, said, you know what? Let's just see how far we can go. A.T. Kearney does not want to work with Marvin Bower, who, by the way, happens to be in Harvard Law, a Harvard-trained lawyer, and one of the first lawyers to go to get an MBA at Harvard Law School. That's not to promote Harvard, but that's just the facts. So these two guys were the sort of like most senior partners at this accounting firm, auditing firm, actuary firm, whatever you want to call it, called James O. McKinsey. A.T. Kearney stayed in Chicago, where McKinsey was actually founded, and Marvin Bower came to New York to found the first office in 1936, actually, but 35 was like still an important year. So, now we're about to enter a new age. Marvin Bower was a Jones Day lawyer for like 6 or 7 years. He was responsible for bankruptcy. Back then, law was pretty much, you know, white glove, or white shoe, or whatever. People didn't really get too messy into the details of why companies went bankrupt. They just did the paperwork. Marvin Bower was like a modern day, what's that guy's name? The guy E equals MT squared?
Einstein.
Sorry, I'm not a scientist. I'm a consultant. So Marvin Bower was like a modern day Einstein. He looked basically looking around all these bankruptcy things and said, you know what, these companies have easy to fix problems. So let me start fixing the companies by working for a new type of company. So he met McKinsey, they got together, he became beloved, McKinsey died, he took the firm to New York, and now you have McKinsey and Company, and that's all it was called. He said, you know what, I'm gonna call it McKinsey because I don't want, when I go to a client, he was like almost 40, by the way. He still was too young at the time to really tell companies what to do. So, you know, 1936 came around, 1940s we saw the war. During the 1940s, government really started taking a more proactive approach to manipulating us and controlling us, and really spending our tax, hard-earned taxpayer money hiring companies like Halliburton and Bechtel, and of course, Booz Allen, our good old Booz Allen company. Sometime around the 1960s, 1970s, Anderson, Mr. Anderson, I'm sure you know of this company, Anderson Consulting, went bankrupt a couple of years ago. Actually, not bankrupt, they got sued out of existence. Anderson was in the 1960s, 1970s, had a big accounting firm, one of the big 16 at the time, or something like that. And they were, started sometime around here, the 1890s to the 1900s. And Anderson was pushing their own technology vendors to help them figure out this new technology to, you know, calculate stuff better. What happened was Anderson took this technology to their clients. Their clients loved it, and Anderson launched Anderson Consulting to advise on technology. It wasn't so much, it was about installing big, humongous room-sized mainframes and managing all that stuff, and IBM really, another stupid decision by IBM to give a competitor the business, but that's beyond the point. So Anderson Consulting eventually became Accenture, that's what it is today, and Anderson, the accounting firm, you know, went kaputs for their assistance in the Enron and WorldCom, and, you know, just about every massive lawsuit and fraud in the history of accounting was perpetuated by Anderson. So anyway, that I'm going to leave it there because the rest, as you probably know, is you know, hopefully you're a little bit more familiar with. Today, no consulting firm has gone public except Accenture, if you could even call that a consulting firm. IBM launched a consulting firm, then bought PricewaterhouseCoopers Consulting Division, and then they became what they are today. And I'm sure, you know, the rest of Booz Allen and Company is like $11 billion monster, and all they do is, their primary source of businesses is government contracts still, not surprisingly. And then guys like Bruce Henderson was, who knows who Bruce Henderson was? Boston Consulting Group. He launched Boston Consulting Group out of, I forget whether he either started at Booz Allen or A.D. Little or even McKinsey, but he launched it in the 1960s because he did not like the way consulting as a business was run. Mr. Ted Bain followed sometime in the late 70s, 80s with Bain and Company. And surprisingly, since that time, very few individuals have launched any interesting or any innovation in the business of consulting. You got guys like Michael Porter. I'm sure you've heard of Porter's Five Forces. He launched it in the 80s. He's actually surprised. He's like an old guy, but he doesn't seem like from all his images and photos online, but he's really old. He launched sort of in the 80s, and his company, Monitor, in case you haven't heard of that one. But since then, there hasn't really been too many companies. Here's a couple of facts. Interesting. I hope you find them interesting. Prior to what's this big outsourcing guys? I forgot the name of these.
White
from
Tata?
Yes. What's the other one?
Tata Consulting?
No, the other one.
Infosys.
Prior to Infosys, and Infosys sort of led the way for Indians and Indian Americans to get involved in launching consulting practices. Tata came after that, even though they're older. And Wipro sort of isn't even considered a consultant. They just, give us your labor force and we'll just handle the rest. There have been almost, to my knowledge, I mean, I am not Asian, but there are no Asian consulting firm leaders. There are, of course, guys who get sent to Japan, get sent to China, and they become very distinguished in their respective countries. But in the U.S., there's very few Asian Americans who have founded consulting firms. There is almost no Black or Hispanic firms other than mine, which I found out about 4 or 5 years ago. And I didn't realize that at the time. I didn't set out to do that. I just didn't want to work for anybody. And there are no women managed strategy consulting firms. So there's, if anyone wants to sort of pioneer, that's your chance. So, any questions on that? Now, I'm sure you know that there are different types of consultants. There's tech, there's HR, and each one is like splintered into like 1,000 different ones. There's strategy, and this is, marketing, and innovation, and blah, blah, blah. And what else is there? Operations, which are typically engineers, blah, blah, blah. I would like to speak about every single one let me first a disclosure. I consider myself a strategy consultant. So, everything else is kind of like, I'm biased towards a lot of different things. And this is sort of like the order I see in terms of importance, that's just my own preference. Now, if you have yet to make up your mind as to what type of area you'd like to specialize in as a consultant, this is pretty much not the limitations of what you can be. Tech consulting started out pretty much like I told you, Anderson, sort of started installing mainframes and said, we got a pretty good idea here. Let's charge $1 million to install a room and see how much we can make off of that. Tech subsequently became ridiculously complex, and you have companies like Forrester trying to help companies understand tech before they even install it, and then Accenture, and they actually do the installations and they work with SAP and then et cetera, et cetera. And then what happens is tech stopped being a matter of installing things, it started being a matter of, well, what should we be installing, and why, and how does that, yield any profit to the bottom line? HR, you've got those guys who specialize in benefits, and those guys who specialize in actual, strategy. Strategy is like, you don't have an HR structure, or your culture is crappy. Let's try to fix it. By the way, this more so than tech was one of the first. This was probably the second oldest line of business. This is the first oldest line of business. Line of business, I mean, between 1900s and approximately 1960s, consulting was all about operations, process improvement. A train isn't running on time. Let's follow it around and see why not. People aren't, working out properly. People aren't buying all the things that they're buying. Let's sit in the store and see what we can improve to fix this and fix that. It was all about literally squeezing every penny out of a process. This is what Rockefeller actually mastered, and then these guys sort of said, oh, we can do it too. And they started charging companies ridiculous amounts of money. McKinsey made all their money from Royal Dutch Shell. They literally just improved the whole process around the country in this massive engagement that they were fortunate enough or lucky enough to get. And so process improvement, a matter of, it's like an engineering thing. Any one of you could do it. It's ridiculously simple. I don't even know how these guys got away with charging so much money for it. But you basically just sit around, you watch people, see what they do, you count them. Let's say you're an employee at a company. How many movements of your arm you make in order to do anything? How long it takes you to stand up, go to the copy machine, and go back. That's process improvement. That's what these guys are doing. Then they diagram the whole thing on a big, massive wall and try to get everybody, okay, put that stuff on there. What do you think you're doing? Put how long it takes you to do it. And then because everybody was participating, it became like this big company thing. And before you knew it, like the whole company, they used to call it brown papering. you know, they were like, oh, wow, look at that, look, you know, all these things that were so obvious, like, duh. These guys were getting paid to tell them. And then, worse still, they got, like, you idiot, why didn't you know that? Like, that was part of the consulting process, telling people that they're idiots. So that was pretty much the bulk of the business, but what happened? Eventually, they actually process improved the entire corporate America. So after you improve the processes of every company in the country, what do you do next? Let's invent something. Good old McKinsey, always in front line of inventing useless practices. But McKinsey said, let's find something called organizational behavior, organization and culture. Wow, that sounds real catchy, real sweet. They launched an organizational, like part of HR, organizational stuff, where basically they said, you know, let's just quantify stuff that you really can't quantify, like, you know, why people hate each other. And then let's charge for it. So McKinsey comes in and says, you know what, you guys aren't friends. Maybe if I put you over here and put you over there, you work better together. $1 million. Like, that's how they basically work. Organizational behavior is one of those, organization and culture is one of those really, really, really fascinating things that is so abstract. You could say anything and get away with it. So that became the leading business line from the 1960s and onward. Even today, almost every single engagement consists of some organization or cultural thing. From merging a company, well, you gotta get the cultures aligned, to just about anything, to, you know, launching a new service business, who are gonna have staff that business? Almost everything. And if you start working as a first year associate at any of these firms, you will very likely be inundated with useless facts about organization and culture that you know are useless, but that's pretty much how they get paid. The more useless facts you accumulate, the more money you can charge. So, the next leading line of business became technology, because people, you know, a big shot CEO who doesn't even have a computer on his desk, and, you know, he doesn't know anything about technology. All he knows, and you will have a lot of guys tell you, they don't even check email. Like, that's a thing of pride. Like, I don't even own a BlackBerry. Like, okay. But because of that, they got to pay Accenture $500 million a year. I want to talk to that CEO, because he obviously needs some culture. He obviously needs some operation process improvement, but that's how technology sort of evolved. And technology is like an entirely different species of consulting. And then finally you have strategy. Strategy is like a real nut to crack. Strategy is even more abstract than organization and culture. Why? Because you can say anything about anything, and you don't actually have to do anything to say all those things, and you can still get paid for it. That's why I love it so much. So strategy consulting, innovation. Innovation is telling you, the client, you were an idiot. You don't know anything. You spent all this money on payroll, and nobody in your company has a new idea. So hire us. We'll come in there with a whole bunch of new ideas. Although we have the same people from the same classes, from the same schools you have, our ideas are better. So anyway, no, seriously, I'll explain to you why people hire strategy consulting. So you have this whole, you know, world of strategy consulting. Oh, and of course, project management is its own monster. You know, you got to get like certified to manage a project, because it could, you know, it's like, you know. You know, yeah, I don't know if you've heard of this in your marketing classes, but barriers to entry. Barriers to entry is what pretty much can allow anyone to be a consultant. There are none in consulting. Anyone can do it. All you gotta do is call your buddies, call your friends, call your daddy's friends, you know, whoever. And they will pay you money because you got this, or you know who, or he, you know, because there are no barriers to entry to tell people what to do, project managers say, well, we're special, we're cool. You know, we're gonna have certifications. So people can't all be project managers. In other words, you can't manage a project. You know, like who has never managed a project before? I'm just curious. Okay, that's what I thought. So, you know, lawyers have their certification processes, accountants have their certification processes, doctors, all the service professionals, except consulting. For the last 100 years, consultants have never been really qualified to tell their clients what to do. And yet, they're actually the highest billing service professional in history. They can get away with charging 10 times more without those qualifications, without the, you know. So again, the question remains, why on earth would anybody want to hire a consultant? You have no qualifications, you have no certifications, you have, anyone can do it. I mean, I know marketing experts with biology degrees, like, what's going on there? There's two primary reasons, but I'll tell you just the most important, actually, there's many reasons. I'll give you all the ones I can think of. First foremost, the first and most important reason is, maybe I should do the top three. Let's reverse the order. The least important reason is, no one likes to take the blame. No blame. We are in a culture of blame shifters. Nobody likes to be at fault. Who likes to be blamed for anything? Who likes to be the one whose fault it was? You lost the client, you lost the business, you lost the customers. Nobody. So what do you do to shift the blame when you can't shift it on your subordinate? Hire the consultant. Consultants are guaranteed to come in there and do make a mess, even worse mess of things, and then you can just blame them. Isn't that beautiful? You can blame them. And let me tell you this, if they actually manage to do a good job, you can take the credit. Oh, now you get promoted. You become like the VP of a country or something because you brought in a consultant. And you know what? Those darn consultants, they're such a friendly, you know, jolly bunch. Let me give them another $5 million so I can get another raise. And essentially, that's pretty much one of the least important reasons why people bring in the consultants. The number two reason, most folks who care about their companies, their relationships, their homes, whatever you have it, understand that they don't have all the answers. So let's, you know, like I go to a marriage counselor, or like I'll go to, you know, some third party, like your best friend, who, you know, someone's shoulder to talk to or whatever. Let's call them in because they might actually have an answer. You know, they might actually have a good answer. So they're like a third party, you know, that will come in and help you sort of evaluate. They give you, you know, they input new info. Input, like, which is important because no one has a monopoly on new ideas. Nobody can, you know, tell you exclusively, I am the only brain in the country that can tell you this. No, nobody can claim that. And a good executive, a good person who runs a company, they know this stuff. So as a third party, consultants are pretty useful. Now, the number one reason, who wants to take a wild stab at guessing what the number one reason would be, why you want to hire consultants? And this one, I my jaw dropped because after I figured this one out, I was like, man, it's so easy to be a consultant. Who wants to take a wild guess? Why? What's the number one reason companies hire consultants? Anybody? Go ahead.
They don't have the time to deal with those problems.
True, but that fits under number two. Same thing.
Because they have a budget they have to spend on improvement of operations.
True, and that's number three. You give up? This is funny. If you are the CEO of a public company, imagine, you're running things, you're running the show, corner office, you got a whole 3 months before you get fired. You're the main guy, the big shot. Now, there's only two things you really need to manage a company. And that's a very pliant board of directors to make sure that, you know, nobody says anything that's out of line. And insurance. Think about it. If you do something, almost every action you make is legally liable to some group of stakeholders. If I make a decision and it makes money, like $50 billion for the company in one end, but it lost $50 million, there will be a group of shareholders who say, you know what, you cost us $50 million, you bum. We're going to sue you. And of course, you know, there's always a lawyer out there willing to sue. So, if you have insurance, you're cool. You know, not a big deal. The lawsuit, you know, we get the lawyers on board. That's the first line of defense. If they manage to win, we got the insurance to kick in. But guess what? If you do not have a consultant to tell you that you could have avoided this action, you're even more liable than you were if you didn't. In other words, insurance is your first type of insurance, again, or risk management device. Consultants is your second. Now, when I heard this, I'm like, oh my God. You mean to tell me, what I gotta do is tell a CEO, you have insurance? That's it, that's the pitch. That's the pitch. You have insurance? No? Oh, we need to talk. I need $50 million to tell you why you're not gonna get sued. And that's it. This is why companies hire consultants of all shapes and sizes, primarily strategy consultants. I, as a strategy consultant, don't actually have to do anything. I don't have to tell you. I just have to tell you what you have to do, what you could be doing. but I don't actually have to do anything. I don't have to go in and lead your employees by the hand. Come on, guys. I don't have to train them. I don't have to stand and observe, you know, minutia of everyday routines. I don't have to do any of that stuff. All I got to do is tell you, you know what? You could get sued if you do that. Oh, thank you, Mr. Consultant. Thank you, Al. You know, you helped me such a great deal. You probably saved me $50 million. And I will tell you, I might save you $50 million if you listen to what I have to say. Now, if they choose not to do what I have to tell because the $50 billion opportunity is greater, they might still get sued. But you know what? The shareholders who say you lost us $50 million, they don't have a case anymore. Because the lawyers can, you know, the company's lawyers can say, well, we hired the consultants. You know, it was our fiduciary responsibility, and I'm sure you've heard this term, fiduciary responsibility, right? As representatives of shareholders in a public organization, you have an obligation to do what's in the best interest of the firm. That means minimizing taxes to as low as possible. GE pays 4% tax. Imagine that. That means hiring all the consultants on earth. It is not uncommon for most companies to have up to 10 different consultants per department, which means I'm always going to be in business. All you gotta do is just start your company, and you will be in business. And, I mean, not really, but, you know, I mean that. But you understand, you know, now why people hire consultants. This particular lesson, if you learn anything else in your time as a member of the management consulting prestigious group, learn this. This is something they will never tell you. Now, I am skewing this discussion because I founded a firm. Most of you are not prone to go launch a company. It's a lot of sacrifice. You will not make money right off the bat unless you wrote a book, have two or three PhDs. Otherwise, you will suffer for a long time before you start making money. The average time it takes most of these guys to be successful at their business is 10 to 12 years. And that's when they start in their 40s or 50s. I did not know any of this when I started. I said, why not? Anybody can do it. So, if you start a firm, you know, and you want to do it now, and you don't have a book, you don't have decades of experience, you don't have a book of business, no client list, if you don't have any of that, prepare to wait. Be patient. It will come to you if you stick to what you want to do. And, you know, if you want to specialize in something, some even more niche thing than this, you know, you can go right ahead. But this is how you win business. You can network all you want, you can talk all you want, you can say whatever you want. The primary way of finding clients is these three facts, if you just remember that. Now, again, not all of you are going to be looking for clients. You know, you are not going to meet a multi-billionaire as a consultant. So if that's your plan, don't be a consultant. Go into finance. If you want to help clients, really, you want to have a great time, have a flexible schedule, have the company pay for everything, or your company pay for everything. If you simply just want to research to your heart's content any ridiculous topic that comes to mind, which is my reason for getting into it, be a consultant. You will make a few million, you will have the fabulous lifestyle, you will get into every party you want, but you will not be a billionaire unless you start a hedge fund, and that's a whole other story. So, you know, what do consultants do besides pitching clients and giving lectures to prestigious college groups? Consultants sit around doing nothing. I mean, literally, they sit around waiting for stuff to happen, itching for stuff to happen. Come on, phone. Actually, that's how it used to be. Nowadays, we're a little bit more proactive. We go out of our way to talk to people who are beneath us, who just don't have the same pedigree, who don't fully understand the business of consulting. We go out of our way to talk to those folks. We make sure that people have plenty of our collateral and materials handy. We're constantly, you know, doing referrals and stuff. Most importantly, you know, if there's a difference between strategy consultants who just talk about stuff in textbooks or write them, and then there's the consultants who actually come up with new stuff, new ideas. I like to coin the term of variable knowledge and fixed knowledge. I like to call lawyers consultants with fixed knowledge. No, they only know a set bunch of laws, and they can tell you how to bend them or break them or whatever. You know, they don't try to invent new laws. They don't try to go, you know, circumvent that. They just, you know, they might be a little bit creative. That's about it. Consultants have variable knowledge. Strategy consultants have variable knowledge. They constantly read, constantly research, constantly come up with thought leadership and new ideas. Listen, nobody's going to pay you for stuff that they can read in the textbook. They only pay you for stuff that they can't find anywhere else. And I'll be the first one to tell you that every single one of you, if you decide to be a consultant, will be pretty much too expensive to hire. Because each and every single one of you brings together a collection of experiences and insights and information that none of you can, the other, your colleagues, your peers, can come up with. The things you know, I don't know, and the things I know, you don't know. Which, in other words, we can all be successful consultants if we simply remember that nobody pays us for what we know. They pay us for how we perceive things. So I'm really not kidding when I say consultants don't really know a lot. They don't know anything. They don't do anything. Because frankly, you know, you're not really paid for, you know, going out there and doing the study. You're really paid for what you come back with. You know, we need two things. We need risk prevention. So come in here and tell us stuff, come up with stuff that we might not have come up with. And we need, what's the best term? We need encouragement. There's such a thing called willpower, the will to do things. Wars often lack it, which I'm sure you are familiar with. If after a prolonged amount of time doing the same thing, you lose the will to continue it. Well, companies who are now talking to a consultant to tell them, give us a bunch of new ideas to minimize our risk, those new ideas are change. Nobody likes change. So you gotta sell the change. You gotta be encouraging. You gotta be enthusiastic. Come on, guys, you gotta do it. You gotta do it. You're gonna do it. You gotta do it. You're gonna do it. That's 50% of my job. So, what do consultants do? Again, you know, they go look for business, they wine, they dine, they schmooze, they do a little bit of reading, they do a little bit of research. Ideas come from anywhere at any time. So if, you know, you are not, you know, if you do not, if you feel that you are not a bookworm or enough of a bookworm, don't worry, you can still be a great consultant. So that being said, I like to sort of turn your attention to a small little library that I lugged over here for your benefit, of all the books that I have been able to find on the consulting profession. They will absolutely guide you in whether you want to work for one or start one. Whether you think consulting is for losers and it's just a great way to get paid and pay off your debt, or whether you're really serious about this profession. As I'm sure you've already assessed, I'm serious about this profession. They call it the chosen profession. It doesn't choose you, you choose it. In the beginning, there might be, whether you start one, a lot of long hours, or whether you go work for one, a lot of long hours. Your life does not belong to you, it belongs to the endeavor. But if you make it interesting, if you enjoy with the work, that's not a problem. Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You know, you can see these later. The book deals with consulting on a global basis on economics. Consulting Demons. It's a rant, very funny rant, about working at a couple of firms throughout the decades in the 1980s and 90s. House of Lies, an even funnier rant about working at a really big company. I think the company they talk about are BCG and McKinsey. But they don't really name the company. You kind of sort of have to figure it out. Rip Off, some British guy ranting about his consulting experience. Horrible, this book. But it's interesting to see his perspective. McKinsey's Marvin Bauer, the biggest press release I've ever read. This thing is so fluffy, full of good things and great stories about this guy, you know, the modern day founder of McKinsey, that, you know, I'm shocked it even passes for a book. The McKinsey Way, another press piece on McKinsey, talking about all these fancy charts and graphs that they use. It's like, you know, it's not really for the person interested in launching a firm, it's for the person interested in working for them. The World's Newest Profession. This book was recently written. It was done by a British scholar over in Oxford who got his PhD investigating the consulting profession. It's a great read in terms of the history of the firm, but it's incomplete. There's a lot of things missing, a lot of context missing. But he digs deep into the files of all these big consulting firms, and he gives you, like, you know, what happened, how did it all happen. All this stuff about process improvement and, you know, the 1960s onwards came from out of here. And surprisingly, Skadden. Skadden Arps. Anybody ever heard of Skadden Arps? Slate, Meagher & Flom? You know, it was at some point one of the largest law firms on earth, employing hundreds up to 1,000 plus lawyers, which was unheard of prior to, you know, practicing law was very, you know, just a couple of guys, you know, the oldest of the oldest firms, 100, 125 years. Even they did not have as many lawyers as they had. They specialized in mergers and acquisitions. And if you know history, in the 80s and 90s, you had a lot of that going on. These guys facilitated it all. McKinsey hired them to help them improve their culture. So That's an interesting note. And I find it, Cliff asked me last year when I came here, I told him, what are my goals for my firm in the future? And I'll get into that as my concluding piece. My goals at the last year was to find a partner, because I believe partnership was the only way to grow. Every consulting firm is a partnership, by the way. Every law firm, they're all partnerships. Very few get started without that type of financial and, you know, camaraderie support. I was looking for a partner. Shortly before reading Skadden, I said, you know, I'm not really interested. I couldn't find one. I just couldn't find anybody who met my standard. After reading Skadden, I said, no partner for me. Partners are the most dysfunctional type of organizations I can possibly imagine. There's too much bickering, too much infighting, too much inbreeding. So I just said to myself, you know what, let me chill with this partnership stuff. Let me just see how far. I got plenty of time, you know. Most people who ask me how I started, by the way, I assumed you knew who I was. Let me introduce myself. My name is Al Berrios. I graduated from Stern in 2000. I applied for work at MTV and got rejected. I was overqualified. I applied for work at a stock firm and got rejected as underqualified. And I just said, you know what, this is ridiculous. At what point am I going to be qualified enough? And even that qualification only, you know, allotted me about $30,000-$35,000 a year. Let me get this straight. I can go sell for somebody, make them money, or I can forever live a depressed lifestyle because I'm not good enough for anybody, I'm too good for somebody. This doesn't work out for me. So I decided to start October 2000 under the premise that, hey, why not? There's no barriers to entry. Shortly thereafter, I read articles about how the Enron thing, the WorldCom thing. One of the law firms dealing with the bankruptcy of United Airlines was billing $900 an hour. And I said to myself, damn, that's a whole lot of money. You know, I'm accustomed to $10 an hour. I'm like, $900? Serious cash. And the next paragraph down, like paragraph 36 out of 39, and McKinsey and Company was brought on a board at $2 million a month to advise them on the bank on how to get out of the bankruptcy. I'm thinking, let me get this straight. The newspaper finished telling us they went into bankruptcy, and these are the reasons why, and suggested ways to get out of the bankruptcy and fix the company. But the company had to hire McKinsey at $2 million a month to tell them everything that you could have read in that same article. I found my profession. That was it. I said, I gotta be what these guys are doing, and I'm gonna be a consultant. That very next day, I called up the guy who did my business card, yo, switching the company, changed the website, everything, and became just a consultant. Since that day, no one has ever asked me, what qualifications do you have? No one's ever asked me what degrees I have. No, few people ask me what school I went to. And you're not going to find what school I went to in my bio either. So you consider yourself privileged. No one asks me how many consulting engagements I've done. Nobody asks me anything. Simply, I come in, I get referred by somebody, I tell them, this is what you need to do, and I need you to pay me X, Y, Z amount of dollars a month, and they will pay me that money. No questions asked. I wrote my contract. I'm not a lawyer. They signed my contract. The biggest company that worked for all of them, Viacom, News Corp, Disney, they signed my contract. I'm not a lawyer. They've got teams of lawyers. They review my thing a little bit, whatever, and they signed my contract. I don't even understand how that happened. I insist on getting one of their contracts because I don't know anything about law, but apparently it seems like I wrote a good contract. I've been doing this now. This October 2007 will be my 7th year in business. I have had very, very little income. A good year is where I can spend about $8,000 or $9,000 on myself. The rest of the money goes to the company. I just reinvest it. I pay for payroll. I pay for office space. I pay for all the things I need: computers and travel, everything I need to get the job done. Why? Because I understand that, you know, I started not in my 50s, not in my 40s, not even in my 30s. I started in my 20s. I got a good 50 years to get paid. So let me enjoy my life now by doing things I choose to do, as opposed to running around 90 hours a week for Goldman, running around 90 hours a week for collecting useless information that they're making money off of instead of me. That was my choice, and I do not encourage everyone to do it. There are certain things you need in order to do that. You need no debt. So if you've got parents who are paying off your education, good for you. You're already a step closer to being a consultant. You need no girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever may have you. You need no kids, because then, you know, who needs that obligation? You need a moderately priced rental unit so you can pull it off. And if you've already got a laptop, well, and all those other of the above, then you're on your way. You already are consulting. I kept trying, I kept doing it. I can tell you all kinds of ridiculous experiences that, I mean, this is really just a fun ride. I remember my first horrible experience, I went into the pitch, 70 slide presentation, thinking I'm really gonna impress, I'm really gonna wow them. She fell asleep on slide 30. And I asked her, ahem, do you want me to stop? Should I continue? Oh no, I already know all this. Then why did you have me come in? Oh, it's good practice for my intern. You have me sitting here, my nicest suit. I'm paying this secretary to be here with me. So you, she could, you know, if I could pretend like I'm a big organization, and you're telling me that you already know this, you're not really going to hire me, you're just basically giving your intern a good experience? Man, I called her boss the next day. Like, listen, man, this chick is rude. I don't like her. I don't talk to you and only you. So he gets back to me. So, Al, we're on a conference call, and, you know, my director is here. You know, I'm thinking, oh, this might be hard. So she's telling me, you're no good, you can't do this, you can't do that. I'm like, oh, wait a minute, what is there? You know, hold on, let me give me a chance. And before I could even explain, click, end of story. That was my, one of the most interesting experiences. Other experiences, you know, when you're pitching, before you even get in the door, you got to sort of send some collateral. I'm thinking, let me send some mail, let me send some letters. I used to send letters in font, an illegible font, in size 5, because I was real hip, on regular Staples paper, no letterhead, in an envelope that I sealed with my own spit, and I included a floppy disk, one of those 1.44 meg floppies. I sent them all to these advertising agencies. The only one who responded, and they only responded because I showed up at the office without leaving, and I said, I'm not leaving until I talk to the guy who I sent it to. He sends his assistant, says, oh yes, we got your proposal. It was an advertising agency. We use Max, and your PC formatted disk doesn't work. Oh my God. I spent a fortune sending these things to all these gay guys in advertising agencies. No offense, everybody was gay. Just, you know, retelling an experience, a traumatic experience. This guy was telling me, it's just such a truth, such a thing. I should have known. How could I have known? I sent floppies, PC formatted floppy disks, to a bunch of guys who only use Macs. They were never going to read my proposal. So after that, I kind of sort of stopped sending stuff out. But I learned my lesson. Today, I don't really write proposals. I just pretty much get most of my business from referrals. I talk to people a lot. I maintain, you know, networking contacts and try to do as much writing and speaking as I can, and that sort of helps bring in the business. But that's really the only way. If you are not obligated to bring in the business, most of your day will consist of, you know, fine-tuning your expertise in particular industries, which isn't so bad if you're a big geek and you like it. And there's plenty of opportunities to move around all over the world in different offices. That is not such a great incentive to be a consultant. If you have family, friends, if you want a life. Traveling most of the week or being based in other parts of the world eventually gets tired pretty quickly, you know. My ex, who's a fashion designer, she traveled all over the world. Her biggest dream on earth. I didn't. I knew, you know, I'm not missing anything. But she, you know, that was her career choice. So she traveled everywhere, supervised factories all over the world. And, she's only been doing that 3 years. Hates it. Can't wait to stop traveling. Now, it occurred to me, consulting firms come to these schools and say, you're going to get to travel all over the world. Like, that's a big incentive. Like, that's a big deal. Without telling you that most of our consultants don't want to travel. That's why we're coming to you. So, you know, there's a lot of pluses, a lot of negatives to this business, but it really is what you make of it. And with that, I open the floor to questions. I think I said everything about myself, right? So, I don't leave anything else? No? Good. Any questions? I know I wasn't that thorough. Yes.
What is your firm geared towards, like, a specific part of an industry?
I decided to start to specialize in my niche. I call it behavioral economics. You know, this is a branch of economic science that has existed for 30 years, very, very obscure, not too many people have practiced it, and I discovered it primarily because it helped me understand my own dysfunctional family. I said, you know what? Mom, you're crazy. Dad, you're even crazier. Why? I realized that behavioral economics had the answer. The more I started reading about it, the more in love I felt with it. And eventually I started branching out into all other areas of social sciences. For me to tell you that I'm an anthropologist, sociologist, historian, you know, economist, it's too ridiculous to say. You wouldn't even believe me, even if I told you. I try to specialize in all the social sciences. I focus in on behavioral economics, sort of like as an umbrella science for everything else. What I tell my clients I do, I quantify irrational behavior. I help them understand those, you know, things that don't make any sense. Like, if you price it just right, and you put it right in the store that it needs to be, why won't it sell? I hope you understand that. You know, it is very much all this abstract stuff I was talking about, but my claim is I can help you make sense out of it. I only work in the service economy industry. So, media, hospitality, retail, anything that has to do with, you know, the service economy. As opposed to, you know, like, I could not do anything for GM. You know, GM is too focused on manufacturing, engineering, and, you know, the hard technical stuff. Not much I can do there. And besides, they've already hired every consultant in the world to help them do that. I'm not really going to lend much value. Unless, of course, they want to hire me, I'm going to say no. You know, big, massive airlines, I really can't help them because, you know, 4 million parts in an airplane, what am I going to tell them? And I can tell them how to improve customer service, but, you know, you got to talk to a guy who's focused on a lot more than just the finances and the manufacturing. So what I decided to focus on was that, the specific service details of a business, and my area is pretty much all-encompassing. I deal with shareholders' behavior, human resources and organizational behavior, marketing and consumer behavior. I deal with entrepreneur behavior for franchisees, voter behavior for anybody who wants to understand how politics has anything to do with, political science has anything to do with their voters, altruistic behavior for nonprofits who want to understand how to, you know, I do policy work also for cities who want to understand how, you know, shifting budgets around can help, you know, liven up economies and neighborhoods and revitalize communities. You know, anything that has to do with, you know, a social science and how it applies to the economy. It's very broad, very all-encompassing. I literally can tax deduct anything from my, you know, tax statements. Yes?
Can you explain a little more about the growth of your company?
The growth, sure. Most of these organizations, and this is why BCG was founded and Bain was sort of, they sort of have decided to grow a step ahead of their clients. In other words, they hire people before they have the business, they open offices before they have the business. BCG said that doesn't make any sense. Bain said that doesn't make any sense. Why don't we open offices in lockstep with what our clients want? So if our client wants us to be in Texas, we'll be in Texas. You know. Now, I did not know any of this when I started. When I started, I said, you know, I don't have any money to pay anybody. How can I be these big, like a big competitor if I don't have any funds? And, you know, if I was billing clients, like a couple of $1,000 a month when I first got started, I just couldn't make the economics work. And it was later on I realized you could build 10 times more for doing 10 times less. But what I decided to do was create my own organizational structure. Like, what worked for me and only me? I've written a lot about this structure and how it works, and I've actually employed it. I've actually put it together at other companies. And, you know, it's actually really simple. And, you know, I like to say I'm not really so much a consultant than, you know, a really innovative HR model. Has anybody ever worked in retail before? You know, behind the counter, selling stuff? Good. Anybody else? Good. All right, so we got some experienced, you know, sales clerks. We got, the typical HR model is linear. You know, you get recruited, you know, you get trained, you get, you know, you get a little work, you know, you get fired, you get spit out. They don't want you anymore. You know, this is based on the history of HR as it's evolved in organizations. It's very paternal. You know, once you're done, you're done. We don't want to hear from you again, don't talk to us again. It's changing a little, but this is why, and this is what I do. It's more a cyclical thing, where you can come in from any direction. You don't have to be from a specific school or anything. I train you, I then, you know, put you to do something, and you can choose to either leave and do something else, or you can choose to either stay and continue, do something else, which also includes working at a client firm, which I fully endorse, or continue and train others and then just sort of continue the process. This is more cyclical. This is my model. Now, the difference is, because I do strategy as opposed to operations, strategy is short term. I don't come in there and tell you, I need a year to come up with one idea. No, it doesn't work that way. You can take a year to implement the idea, but you gotta come up with ideas quick. If your client it wants to compete effectively or doesn't want to compete, whatever the case, you gotta help them quickly. So it was a hard lesson to learn, but the way I have to run my businesses is also based on projects. I get one project, it lasts a month, it lasts 2 months, and that's pretty much it. I'm moving on to the next project or waiting for the next one. As a result, I cannot employ anybody on a full-time basis unless I have an occasion for there was a time last year when we had like 5 projects back to back. So I can employ people consecutively for multiple projects or things like that. There are some years that are not. Like in the beginning, I had to literally wait like a month, 2 months, 8 months for the next project. No one's gonna wait. I'm not gonna pay anybody 8 months to sit around and do nothing. And I already told you that's what most people do. And I'm not, and I cannot prevent you from going anywhere else. You have to go pursue your own interests, you know? So the model sort of came, it became like a hybrid 1099. You're familiar with 1099? It's like part-time? Hybrid 1099/W-2. It's called statutory W-2, where I don't necessarily have you work, first of all, as a strategy consultant, you have to work at the client side. That's where you gather your facts. Then, and also the client feels better. They can blame you in case anything goes wrong, or ask you what's going on with this project, or are you almost done? So this process took me almost 7 years to perfect. It has taken me from zero part-timers to over 100 part-timers. Every single one of them works as a pool, depending on what point in the project they want to participate in. I do not force anyone, any single individual, to do every step of the process. You can do any part of the process you're interested in, and you basically get compensated just for that one part of the process for that duration of the project. So if a project lasts 3 months, the project is broken up into 90 different processes, tasks. You can choose to do any one of those 90 tasks, any amount of time you want in a team. And that's, so because of the way this works, I require almost 5 times more people to get the same project done. But because you're only compensated for a very discrete task, the cost of doing that is a whole lot less than hiring 2 full-time consultants. So basically I can undercut anybody who's doing this. Everybody who's working on a project gets paid the equivalent of what they would be getting paid if they were full-timer, except in a very discrete, for a very discrete amount of time, for a very discrete amount of energy that they're offering me. And then at the end of the day, you can choose to stay in the same pool and wait for the next project, or you can go off and do some other career choice you might have. I do work with nurses and doctors and lawyers and people who want to do other things, not necessarily consulting. I just need them for that one discrete thing. Or, anybody ever heard of outplacement? It's supposed to be another box here, but most companies don't always have it. Outplacement is where the company helps you find another job once they kick you out and make that a full-time job. As you can imagine, 100 people means that you're constantly looking for jobs for them. So I'm always looking for opportunities that, my network provides me to provide them, my pool of associates. They typically go from, working on a project for anything for a month to a year, and then I give them the choice to either work for a client. I will help them refer them to something like a law firm or whatever, or they will ask for referrals and letters of recommendations, which I'm more than happy to provide. So it's set up sort of like a massive temp firm doing, but all the effort, all the energy is focused exclusively on doing strategy consulting, as opposed to just, I'm not like a labor pool for other companies. Companies don't even want to hire people up until I introduce them to them through the projects that they hire us for. And that's how it works. So it's taken a very long time to get this. It's not for everybody. There are people who need that steady paycheck every week, every month. So my interview and my recruitment process is very selective. I don't hire just anybody, although anybody can qualify. And I'm very careful with the folks that I do bring in. This is not the typical engagement. Most consulting firms have $1 million office suites, and only 2 suites are being used at any given time. Everyone either works at the client site or from wherever they want. We have an office based at One Liberty Plaza. You can come there for conference room time or whatever, but I do not expect you to be there. If you're there, you're not servicing the client. If I'm there, I'm not getting paid because I got to go out and look for business. So, you know, it's very flexible. Make your own hours, work your own time, work from wherever you want, and it's still a very, very highly productive organization. You know, I with the help of everyone who I've had the privilege of working with, I've been able to publish over 1,000 articles because they, you know, in the 7 years I've been doing this, because they provide me with all the information I need in such a process-oriented way that, you know, again, we are about 10 times as productive as anybody else, you know, but a fraction of the cost. So that's the model. You will probably never hear this anywhere else, ever again. It's something that I figure, you know what, you know, too many guys spend too much time duplicating or reinventing the wheel. You know, they said, oh, I don't like working at McKinsey, so I'm going to go start BCG. I don't like doing this. You know, and I realized, you know, since Michael Porter, there really hasn't been any innovation in the business of consulting. How are you supposed to manage a consulting firm? It's not exclusively a partnership. It's not exclusively, you know, let me hire a bunch of guys and just sit around waiting for business as consultants. No, there's different ways to manage it, but it hasn't been explored because these guys are all and I quote, pale and male. And this is from an actual consulting conference that I went to. It's not to split the business as a racial thing. It's simply to say how too much of the business is too like-minded. There's not enough diversity of thought within much of the hierarchy of broad, big term that consulting firms. So what happens is, if you just want to be a consultant, you emulate what you think you know, instead of trying to come up with something new. Because I didn't know any of this stuff when I started, I came up with something that nobody else did. And the process just took on a life of its own. When I started telling clients about what I was doing, they were like, "Oh, you gotta do this for us here. Because we wanna hire, you know, we wanna reduce our cost of payroll, we wanna reduce all these things." I said, "It won't work for you, or it might work for you." In any event, you know, this is something I developed just for consulting purposes. You could be a graphic arts company. You could be, you know, an advertising agency or marketing firm. You could implement this model. But if you try to change the structure of an established organization accustomed to a more linear way of hiring and working with people, it may not work, and it'll be even worse. You may ruin its culture. So that's how my growth has been. It has been very exploratory, very, you know, I like to think of it as different, alternative, and really my mission, as it states on our website, is I want to offer an alternative perspective to management. Any questions?
How's it doing? I think we have one. Yeah, just one last question.
Anybody else? Okay.
How do you think that the innovative ideas of smaller consulting firms will influence the future of the consulting industry? Do you think?
That's a very good question, and I will tell you what's going on. How can I go to a client and justify a huge bill with a bunch of people working part-time without degrees, without qualifications, without certifications? How can I go there and justify it? Well, if you remember, consulting as it used to be a smart man's game. Smart folks were naturally had more access to information than not so smart folks. Well, sometime around 1998, 99, 2000, this thing called search engines, you know, came out of nowhere. Today, it is possible to identify any piece of information you want. Anyone can do it, anywhere, anytime. That is the basis of consulting. That's the foundation. The ability to identify information that no one else can identify, can find it, have it, like, you know, corporate libraries is a huge business. People used to spend gazillions on stacking their libraries with the most rare and obscure bits of information. Well, that all changed when search technology came into existence. So I go in there and tell my client, the first thing you gotta understand is that information is not exclusive as it used to be before. It's free, anyone can find it. So if you understand that, then you have to understand that I can get any information you need. So at the end of the day, all you're really paying me for is not the information I'm giving you, but the perspective of that information. So, can a small firm exist? Well, what's a small firm? You know, Accenture wrote a study that said headcount is not a measure of productivity or performance. So I don't have to have 100 people. I could do what I do with 2 or 3 people. Accenture doesn't have to have 111,000 people. Excuse me. They could do what they do with a couple of people too. because headcount is not a measure of productivity or performance. It's just a number. A number, which I may add, is the only number that most companies use to talk about how big they are and how successful they are. The number of offices you have, especially today, is not a measure of productivity or performance. You can have one office, you can have 1,000 offices all over the globe. Why? Because you can do anything from any location, any part of the world. So, if that's the case, information is free, headcount means nothing, office space means nothing, what then defines a consulting firm? Think about that, and you will have the answer to your question. In my opinion, you know, I am as big as Bain, I'm as big as McKinsey, I'm as big, you know, that's my humble opinion, and you know, you are entitled to yours. But it's based on that concept, that information is what it is today, it's easily accessible, it's free, anyone can have it. People don't pay me to get it, people pay me for advice. And that's what I offer. I offer advice. So, yes, you will find many, many, many more small guys coming up out of nowhere, reinventing all kinds of ways of offering advice. Whether, you know, I don't know how many exist out there, they might be too small, but you know, that's the future of this business. So I guess that's it. Unless anybody else wants to say. I'll leave the books here so you can write it down if you haven't already. And, you know, it was a pleasure to meet you all. Thank you for having me. Yeah, rub elbows with the owner. Make sure he sees what you're doing. Get to know him. Stay in touch when you leave. Let him know you have ideas, not just regurgitating out of a textbook. And, I often find entrepreneurs like other entrepreneurs. So you may not be interested in starting a firm, but you can fake it, and you'll get a whole lot more attention.
Huh. Okay. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And also, is there anything any other career path or any other job that would better prepare you for consulting or that you...
Nope. Anything you do can make you a consultant. And here's the beautiful part. If you don't want to be a consultant anymore, you can do anything else afterwards. So if you want to be a botanist after your life as a consultant, you can be. Or if you're a botanist now, you can become a consultant.
Okay.
That's why I love it so much. You can make it up as you go along. You can be anything you want, shape it any way you want, and you know you will be successful at it.
So, by the same reasoning, would you think that a consulting job won't necessarily be the best preparation for more consulting in the future?
Well, it depends on what do you want to be like. Are you consulting because you want the wealth and fabulous riches that comes along with it? Or do you just want to broaden your own horizons and perspective intellectually? Like, what do you want?
Yeah, I mean...
If you want to just be smart, then you can, a consulting job now will help you for a consulting job in the future. Although, the more senior you get, the less consulting you will actually do. You'll be spending more time looking for business and researching. So, you know... I'd say that you can accomplish both as a senior consultant, 20, 30 years in the business, but you really have to figure out what you want out of your career as opposed to just working towards the career, The career doesn't define you.
That's good. May I have your contact information?
Yeah, sure. I'm guessing you all want it too, so let me just jump.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
It was nice meeting you.
Take care.
Have a question?
Yeah. I'm Perry.
Eric?
Perry.
Perry. Please Perry. Meet you, Perry. Didn't I meet you last
time? Last time, yeah. Do you find it less interesting now? You're
no.
Only, I mean, you talk about having to go out and find more businesses instead of doing something. Like, have you reached the point where it's too overwhelming?
Well, when you're the founder, no.
Mm-hmm.
Overwhelming, yes. It gets overwhelming all the time. A lesser mortal will probably have gotten out of this business already. But, it's... It, like I said, when you're doing it this way, it is what you make of it. If I don't want it to be overwhelming, I'll stop it.
As it happens, I haven't reached that point yet. The only thing that makes it get there is not so much the business than the personal things that go on around it. You know, your girlfriend this, your mom that, your sister whoever, you know, like that makes it tough. But the business itself never gets hard because you love it. You love the researching. You love the this, you know, you love the networking, you love the pitching, you love the talking to people. So, you know, it hasn't gotten tiring. I've confessed. I will probably die doing this. And if my clients felt otherwise, they would not trust me with their most deepest secrets. Because then I could just go off and do it and replicate their business. So the enthusiasm and the energy and the passion I bring to the business is almost like part of the pitch. Because if they thought for a second that I was going to betray their trust in me as a consultant, or I was going to steal their ideas or corporate secrets, they wouldn't hire me.
Do you think a consulting job is a good channel to learn about different businesses you start your own?
Yeah.
That only means starting a consulting business.
Many entrepreneurs, or I should say many people who start businesses, it's not the same. Many people who start businesses are former consultants. Many, surprisingly.
What do you mean it's not the same?
Entrepreneurs and people who start businesses can be two different things. If you are an entrepreneur, there's at least three ways to classify you. And one of those is a person who just starts a business. There's professional entrepreneurs. You know, they're the guys who are former executives at companies and want to just do something with what they know as opposed to just really passionate about starting something new. There's the people who just live off of this stuff. So, you know, they don't really have a choice. They have to do this or they won't get paid or make a living and feed their family. And then there's the serial guys. They're like these visionary guys. All they want to do is just start. They don't necessarily have to do it or make money. They just start. They start and bounce. You know, like that's three different types of entrepreneurs. You know, consultants who are familiar with an industry and want to do something else, I will classify them, and want to start a business, I will classify those as the professional kind, the professional entrepreneur. They understand the business. They're not trying to reinvent the wheel, just an incremental improvement over something that they think should be improved, and that's pretty much it. There are, and it's not exclusive. Like, you can be combinations of any one of those things. So you can be a visionary professional entrepreneur, in which case, you know, you see the incremental improvement, you start it, and then you do something else. So entrepreneurship is a very broad term. It shouldn't be thrown around lightly. You know, the people who go off and do that, not everybody understands the sacrifices and what goes into it. So I don't advise everyone to do that.
Right.
So that's how it works.
Okay.
But yes, it's a great platform to launch a business in the future.
Okay, thanks.
Hello?
Hi, my name is Pete.
Pete.
Yeah. What's a great way to create like your own unique perspective on things, like a way to see things differently than everyone else does?
Well, like this. And just read whatever you want to read. Look at whatever you want to look at. When you observe something, question why it's occurring that way. When you block out what all the nonsense everybody else tells you, you're going to come up with a different way of doing things. That's a simple, short answer. You know, having your own opinions and your own thoughts, you really have to constantly question, are they really mine? Where did I get them from? You know, when you read an article, are you now sharing the same ideas that the article had and telling everybody else around you, I read this article and that's what I think. Is that what it is? Or are you really asking, well, why did this happen? Why did that happen? Well, if you can ask yourself, after you've read something, what happened and why, now you're having new ideas.
How do you manage to keep everyone together? I mean, that structure seems like everyone's in and out.
I don't do it myself. I got a couple of managers to help me out with it. Some assistants who keep track of the payroll and stuff. You know, my primary role is to find the people, and you know, I assign others. Each one, like, they all train themselves. Mm-hmm. The training is automated too, so there's a website you can go to get trained for certain specific tasks. Everything is, I get the project, I make this thing model, I develop the training, you know, and then I assign trainers. And then everybody gets into a team, and then it sort of works. It works itself. I don't do everything myself. I couldn't. You know, so it over the years, you know, because everybody's assigned in a team to do the same task, it's a great way to benchmark, and you can find the best of the best. If you're doing the same thing as he's doing, one of you is going to do a better job. So I just ask you to come back next time, and then you will then now either train somebody new, or be a senior member of part of another team, but you're still doing the same thing you were doing before. You're just getting a little bit more money, a little bit more fun, maybe even the opportunity to even recruit other people, because I do that all the time. Empowering someone to hire others, great way to build loyalty without paying for it. So You keep, you know, it just feeds itself and it just grows and grows and grows on its own. All I do is just put it in motion.
I'm actually interested in human resource consulting.
Okay.
What exactly is a corporate culture? Like, I know the general scheme of things, but...
Corporate culture is like your family compared to his family, compared to my family. You know, everybody thinks their family is crazy and dysfunctional, when in fact, it's just the culture of the family. Mm-hmm. Whatever your family is like is what makes your family special to you. Special to you and special to me. Or not. Mm-hmm. That's what corporate culture is. Corporate culture is whatever makes it like a distinct little family.
Is it even possible for a third party member to come in and say, there's something wrong with this, you should fix it?
Well, I never like to say there's anything wrong with anything, but I mean the business really is built around saying that there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. If you can say it in as scientific a way as possible, if you can say it like that, you can get away with saying there's something wrong. So, you know, I like to say there's not something wrong, but maybe an individual here is, you know, could be more utilized in a different department. As opposed to this guy's an idiot, get rid of him. Which could be a lot easier to say. So, so that's just how I do it. So, you know, you got to be careful. You're talking about somebody's family in somebody's house, no less. People get really flustered, really frustrated. You know, Bain did a project for Nike once last year. It was so horrendously executed that the president of Nike got fired. Because, you know, it's just, you know, they did not understand the culture of Nike. You know, so you're going in there, you're going to criticize somebody's family, somebody's dog, somebody's kitchen set. You know, you're going to have to be careful with that. Mm-hmm. People do always forget that. People never recognize. Don't criticize. You know, I may hate your mamas, but I'm never going to tell you that. That's the problem. So that's why, you know, you have organizational HR consultants. You got to be careful with those guys. Those guys are, you know, they don't all have the right personality to deliver that type of advice. Then there's the benefits guys. The benefits guys, all they do is set up benefits plans. And they call that consultant. You know, sit you up with IATA or sit you up with all kinds of companies and tell you, well, you know, and keep track of the most, like, little itty-bitty details of the time you spend in an organization or whatever in that. You know, that's not consulting. That's just setting up payroll and stuff. Anyway.
Thanks a lot for your advice.
Hope that helps.
Can I get a contact?
Yeah. No problem. Don't abuse it.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. Pleasure. Take care.